All right, y'all, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah. Liberty Radio Network, live on the weekdays. It's just anti-war radio. That's all it is, man. I talk about the cops, too, but mostly it's about the wars. I talk about the banks, too, but mostly it's about the wars. And I talk about the politics and stuff, but mostly it's about the wars. And mostly, hopefully, mostly, geez, at least half the time, right, it's interviews of journalists who know the things. That's why I know so many things that I tell you all the time. It's because I interview the best journalists in the world about it all the time. And I've been doing it for a long, long time. For example, Gareth Porter he's the greatest. He's my very favorite of all. Since I think the first month that this show started as a daily venture there in January of 2007, I interviewed Gareth about, man, are they about to bomb Iran? And he said, nope, at least not till summer. And here's why. And it was a really smart answer of why. Well, it wasn't that smart. It was, but very observant. Anyway, and I interviewed him, must be a couple hundred times since then. Seriously, literally, a couple hundred times since then. Because the guy's a brilliant genius, and he writes about everything that I care the most about. So there's Gareth Porter. I want you to read him. That's what this show should be called. The Scott Horton Tries to Convince You to Read Gareth Porter Show. Because if we lived in a world where everyone read Gareth Porter, then, I don't know. I have to imagine things would be a little less violent. I have to imagine that. Anyway, Charlotte Silver's going to be on from the Electronic Intifada to talk about what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians again and what the Palestinians are trying to do about it. That's a sad story. I'm going to try to just let her explain and stay out of it as much as I can for that one because, yeah. And then Ray McGovern is going to be here to talk about the MH-130 report. You know, I knew I forgot something. I was going to try to read that thing this morning, but I didn't. But I did read a little bit of journalism about it. I think I know enough to ask him some questions. We're going to see what Ray has to say. Gareth, Charlotte, Ray, today on the show. Okay, good. Hey, this morning I was interviewed on 970 AM in Fargo in North Dakota. Isn't that where Fargo is? Yeah. You ever seen that movie? Of course you did. This guy named Jack Seaman. Seaman? It's S-E-A, you know. He's a sailor. Sickos. And Jack, he interviewed me about the wars. He said, can you sum up what's going on in Syria? I said, no. I mean, I can't. Oh, he said, can you sum up what's going on in Syria right now? And I said, no. But if you let me back up a minute, I can try to sum up what's going on in Syria. But we can't start with today. We have to go backwards first. So, a little bit of that. Basically the same thing you hear me say every day, only hopefully a little more concise because of the time pressures, but I do go on. It's a lot to try to fit in. I think I might have lost him too, because he said, wait, what? I need to think of like punchy catchphrases, you know? That's what makes narratives, not facts. Things that people can remember. Anyway. Maybe that'll be online at some point, I don't know. It's, again, 9:70 a.m. in Fargo. And I wonder, you know, with the way I talk and the speed at which I talk, I wonder if anybody listening got it. They're probably like, geez, this guy, I don't know what he's saying. Talking so fast with that Texas accent, I can't understand him. I don't know. But, yeah, there. Okay, yeah. Good, I'm almost out of time for this segment, so I'll keep this part of the show short. Did you watch the Democrat debate last night? Me either, except a little bit of it. I missed the whole foreign policy part. Chat room guys, if you have foreign policy parts of the Democrat debate you'd have me mention or whatever, you got to tell me, because I don't know. You tell me the facts, and I'll rail against them, but I didn't watch it. But well, the one thing I know is that Hillary's excuse for the Iraq war is, well, Obama still hired me to be a Secretary of State anyway, so if he doesn't care, then you can't care either, which is a really great argument, Hillary. Yeah. And according to Matt Barganier's tweet, look at the crowd applause as she glosses over her Iraq war vote. Anyway, most of what I heard him talk about was about the crash. The crash of the economy and the severe hardship on the American people. And I heard a lot of railing against the rich and powerful, which is fine, you know, but it'd be helpful maybe if you accused them of doing the things that they actually did in order to do the thing. And I'll try to say this in a way to appeal to liberals more. How about that? There's a movie called Inside Job. It's about the banks, and it's narrated by Matt Damon. It's very well produced, and it's a documentary, and it's all about the crash. And it's all about how they sold all these mortgage-backed securities and how they did the blind double-swap insurance where they insure your house and then burn it down and make the money kind of thing. And all of this corruption and the derivatives and the tranches and the mortgage-backed this, that, and the other goddang fraud pushed onto the teachers' union retirement fund and all the rest of it, right? I'm 100% for every assertion in there, I think, pretty much. It's been a couple years since I saw it. But they're 100% right about all this. Everything that they accuse Bear Stearns of Goldman Sachs and whoever, oh yeah. And then don't even get me started on the bailout part, because we're not even on the bailout. We're talking about how it got the way it got. But here's the gigantic, the bigger than the solar system, glaring omission in the movie Inside Job, narrated by Matt Damon, about how the banks caused the crash and all that. And that was, where were the banks getting the money from that they were loaning into these ridiculous bubble markets? Where did the money come from? Follow the money. Follow the money. They follow the money all the way to the Chase, but they don't ever ask, where was the Chase getting the money? They don't ask, where was Citigroup getting the money? Well, it's J.P. Morgan Chase now. I know, but whatever. Stay with me here. Other part of my brain that I imagine speaking for you out there. Where were they getting the money? The Federal Reserve gave them a license to print money. That's what it is. Is their fractional reserve ratio is regulated by the Fed. And the government creates debt. The banks buy the debt. And then they you know, introducing new money into the economy. And then all that money gets put right back into somebody else's bank account. And then they can loan out even more money based on that money that gets redeposited. And then that money gets redeposited. And then they loan out even more money based on that. It's called fractional reserve banking, artificial bank credit expansion. The law, police power, Matt Damon, police power is what created the money that the banks used to build up all the fraud and all the mortgage-backed derivative double default swap jam that blew up the thing. God damn it. It was the central bank, the government, Alan Greenspan, and his force of law. And this is the central fact missing from the entire debate last night at the Democratic presidential primary debate, and the entire debate about the economy and the way it runs and why it is the way it is in this country. Everybody wants to fight about wages, this, that, and everybody wants to fight about regulation, this, that, and nobody ever wants to talk about bank credit expansion and how that is the reason for the boom and the bust. I got an email this morning. The guy said, you know what? I come from the left. I don't agree with you on everything, but I get it about the bubbles. The government causes the bubbles through the bank credit expansion. Yes, exactly. You don't have to agree with a libertarian on any other fact or on any other opinion about how society should be run or any other thing, any welfare program or regulation, this, that, or the other. You must recognize the truth. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you kids, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Now, look here, Dara Jamail, why he's so busy writing a book, he can't do my show. Can't wait to read it, man, if it's about what his article's about. Did you see Antiwar.com today? The Spotlight article today on Antiwar.com is by Dara Jamail. And it's so good, man. And the reason that I like it so much and made it the spotlight is not so much the story of the guy he's talking about, Bert Sachs, who was a great anti-war activist of the 1990s era, apparently, who did a lot of great work. He's now 72 years old, who did a lot to speak out against the first Gulf War and the blockade against Iraq. After that, and the thing of it is that, man, there's just so much important stuff in there. I beseech you to check it out. It's at truthout.org. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. One man's mission, justice for Iraq. One man's mission, justice for Iraq. And, yeah, man. Hang on. I got to mark this important email as important here. Okay, sorry. While in Boston in 1994, full-time peace activist Bert Sachs made a decision that changed his life forever. He decided to seek out a study produced by a group called the Harvard Study Team, which had reported to the Washington Post that the deliberate destruction of Iraq's civilian infrastructure by the U.S. military, along with the U.S.-led economic sanctions against that country, were likely to cause 170,000 Iraqi children to die. Again, that's the destruction of their civilian infrastructure in the first Gulf War. Was likely to cause 170,000 Iraqi children to die. Unfortunately, that estimate would turn out to be far too low, as President Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, famously put it.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
She went on to win the Presidential Medal of Freedom. It was granted to her by Barack Obama. Since that time, 21 years ago, I could not leave this issue alone, Sachs, a kind, soft-spoken 72-year-old activist from Seattle, told Dara Jamail, writing for Truth Out here. He went on to make 9 trips into Iraq, the first one in 96 as part of a Voices in the Wilderness delegation, and in an effort to, quote, educate myself and my fellow Americans about the disastrous effect of this policy on Iraqis. For his efforts, in 2002, he was fined $10,000 by the U.S. Office of Foreign Assets Control for the heinous crime of bringing $40,000 worth of medicine to sick and dying Iraqi children in Basra, Iraq, during his second trip there in 1997. And of course, what's funny about that is down in Basra, the population is almost uniformly Shia, and these are the people that America's strangling Iraq to death and bombing and blockading them in the name of protecting from the menace Saddam, the no-fly zone reaction to the Great Bay of Pigs in the desert stab in the back after the first Gulf War when Bush Sr. urged them to rise up and then betrayed them. Oh, in fact, I have that soundbite too.
There's another way for the bloodshed to stop, and that is for the Iraqi military and the Iraqi people to take matters into their own hands, to force Saddam Hussein, the dictator, to step aside.
And, of course, the Voice of America and everything played that over and over again. Anyway, sorry, let me continue here. So this guy, he refused to pay the fine, blah, blah, blah. Let me skip to the facts here. I'm sorry. It's all mixed together, the narrative of the activist and the story that he told. All right. Sachs was horrified by the 91 Gulf War, but even more taken aback by the ensuing U.S.-led sanctions. On March 22, 1991, I read a New York Times front-page story, which Dar links to here, covering the U.N. report by... the U.N. report on the devastating, quote, near-apocalyptic conditions in Iraq after the Gulf War, he explained. The report read, quote, famine and epidemic were imminent if massive life-supporting needs are not rapidly met. The long summer is weeks away. Time is short. The U.N. report recommended an immediate survey of civilian damage caused by the U.S. bombing of Iraq and an immediate cessation of the sanctions in order to prevent imminent catastrophe. Sachs told Truth Out that one particular sentence of that article, quote, has stayed with me for nearly 25 years. It says, quote, ever since the trade embargo was imposed on August 6th, after the invasion of Kuwait, this is 1990, the United States has argued against any premature relaxation in the belief that by making life uncomfortable for the Iraqi people, it will eventually encourage them to remove President Saddam Hussein from power. Quote, even today it's hard for me to read this article without a deep feeling of shame that my country would do such a thing, Sachs has written, that there would not be a major uprising of citizens over what was such an unequivocal war crime against the most vulnerable part of the Iraqi population, the children, end quote. No, continuing, actually. This is the practice of total war as followed in World War II, Sachs said. No civilians are exempt from the war. Not the elderly, not women, not even little babies. That's the end of the quote there. Again, I'm reading Dar Jamail from truthout.org today. It is all well documented to this day how the U.S. government deliberately targeted the civilian infrastructure of Iraq with bombing runs. Again, 1991, first Gulf War we're talking about here. Then forbade the importation of critical components to rebuild water treatment facilities, electrical grids, and hospitals, and forbade the import of medicine, as well as things as basic as food and pencils. The U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency published a 1991 document, again he links to the document, with the subject line, Iraq Water Treatment Vulnerabilities. The document notes that Iraq was dependent upon the importation of equipment and chemicals needed to purify its water supply, and went on to add, quote, failing to secure supplies will result in a shortage of pure drinking water for much of the population. This could lead to increased incidences, if not epidemics, of disease. The entire Iraqi water treatment system will not collapse precipitously. Full degradation of the water treatment system will probably take at least another 6 months. End quote. The drumbeat of assaults carried out directly against the Iraqi people. That was a DIA report. The drumbeat of assaults carried out directly against the Iraqi people continued in the aftermath of the 1991 bombing campaign. On May 27, 1991, then Secretary of State James Baker III infamously stated, quote, we will never normalize relations with Iraq so long as Saddam Hussein remains in power. The statement effectively served as a death sentence to well over 1 million Iraqis who died as a result of the sanctions between 1991 and 2003. Less than a month later, Washington Post article was titled, Allied Air War Struck Broadly in Iraq. Officials acknowledged strategy went beyond purely military targets. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the Liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, guys, welcome back. So, yeah, sorry, I should have done a better job of highlighting which points or whatever. But anyway, please go and read Dar Jamail today at Truthout. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. And he's got all the quotes and the documents and the original reporting from years ago all about the deliberate targeting of the civilian population of Iraq by George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. It's such important, work there. I do hope you'll read it. Okay, now, on to our first guest. It's our good friend, Gareth Porter, and he wrote this thing for Truth Dig. That's different than Truth Out. Truth Dig at truthdig.com. Why the U.S. owns the rise of Islamic State and the Syria disaster. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. Thanks again, as always.
I really appreciate you joining us here, and I really appreciate that you wrote this article because, as always, you do the best job of making the case you're making, putting together all the most important facts that people need to know as you make your case. And it's a controversial one. It's the plain truth. It's as plain as day. And yet, basically, you're accusing Barack Obama of high treason. Oh, and the entire Republican and Democratic and national security establishment of backing America's enemies. And so I'll let you go ahead and make the case.
Well, I mean, I have a different way of formulating it. I don't say that
you didn't use that term. That's mine. Yeah. I said basically.
I know. I understand. I mean, you know, from my point of view, what's happening is it's a classic case of the national security state doing one thing because it serves their interest, as always, thinking they're very clever about it, and never bothering to really seriously take into account. Or being willing to acknowledge, let's put it that way, the serious consequences, which do indeed give power to people who want to harm the American, the United States, and the American people. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you know, here's the thing about it too. This is a fun little footnote that didn't make it into your piece. You may be unaware, but there's a libertarian journalist named Ben Swan who was a local TV news reporter at one point. And he interviewed Barack Obama in 2012, in the spring of 2012. He said, "Mr. President, you know, you're bombing Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and in Yemen, and yet it seems like you sided with Al-Qaeda in Syria. How do you explain that?" And Obama says, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, well, we agree and acknowledge that there are Al-Qaeda guys and bad guys and extremists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, on the side of the rebellion in Syria. And that's why we're only giving non-lethal aid and we're only giving it to very carefully vetted moderate factions, whatever. But we know that that's a damn lie. We know that the CIA was giving very lethal aid in great quantities and was orchestrating, according to the New York Times, was orchestrating our allies doing the very same thing. And very much and very obviously deliberately backing, in effect, the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda in Syria, who absolutely dominated the field at that point."
Well, I mean, I agree in part with what you're – with the way you've put it, but there's also a very important distinction here, both in terms of time and in terms of what the CIA was doing covertly. I mean, one of the – pieces in my article that people are probably not familiar with, I think very few people are familiar with, is that in 2011, the CIA, and this is a revelation that Cy Hirsch originally made last year in his article on Syria, the CIA had a very convoluted, deep covert operation to take the armaments that were acquired from the former Libyan government, the Gaddafi regime, after the overthrow of the regime in 2011, mm-hmm. and have it arranged for it to be sent to Syria. And, you know, we have an accounting of this from the DIA, from our DIA report that has been now declassified and released to Judicial Watch. So that's the document that I linked to in my article. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, there are a lot of questions about this that are not answered. Exactly who the intended recipients were at that point. But, you know, there's no specific evidence at this point or reason to believe that what the administration thought it was doing was supporting al-Nusra. However, you know, it became pretty clear very soon, at least by 2012, that many of the arms that were going into Syria, particularly those arms that were being sent by the Saudis, the Qataris, particularly the Saudis and the Qataris, were in fact falling into the hands of al-Nusra. So that's the key point here, that it was known by 2012 that arms that were going to whoever, and we don't know the exact identities of the commands that were being sent the arms, were in fact being eventually falling into the hands of al-Nusra Front. And this was admitted even by Hillary Clinton in her memoirs, that, you know, they understood that this was going on, and that this was a risk. So this was a risk of what Petraeus later on proposed, and that started in late 2012. I don't know the exact date, but, you know, later in 2012, Petraeus was proposing this operation to vet commands and actually, you know, weed out those people who were pro al-Nusra Front or pro ISIS, and give arms and train them. But it was understood that there was a risk involved in this precisely on the basis of that history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, sorry, everybody, but I've got to play it again. This is Hillary from, I forget now, Gareth, if it's very late February, very early March, 2012. Hillary on CBS is being confronted, of course, with the standard conventional wisdom question. Why aren't we doing more to overthrow Assad? Why the dithering Hillary? And she's defending the Obama administration. This is when she's still Secretary of State, of course.
We know al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria? Uh-huh. Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a Secretary of State and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
All right. And we know that all throughout 2012 and 2000, all throughout 2012, she tried two or three times the whole Friends of Syria charade, to create, Syrian governments in exile, basically in hotels in Qatar, et cetera. And they all immediately endorsed the al-Nusra Front as soon as they were formed, because it was their only stab at legitimacy would be to, endorse the fighters on the field, the guys who are loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. And, so there's, again, on the record, as you say, in her memoirs, too, admitting she knows better, but then doing it anyway, Gareth.
Right. And they even, you know, they were also discussing, because the CIA had done a detailed study at the request of the White House of the experience of supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and what the blowback consequences of that were. And so that was very much on everybody's mind as this question of trying to create and arm and train a Syrian rebel force was being seriously discussed. And of course, we now know that, you know, Hillary was joining with Petraeus in pushing for this program that Petraeus had cooked up. But which the White House at that point turned down, only to agree a few months later to a variant on the same program.
Yeah, and every once in a while, the fact that these are the bad guys from Iraq War II, this is the Zarqawiite fringe of the Sunni-based insurgency that killed 4,000 Americans during Iraq War II. That's who we're talking about here, whether it's Nusra or ISIS. They're just the two different divisions of that same group. from just 10 years ago. Less.
Absolutely. And of course, as you know, better.
Hold it there, Garrett. Let's let him hear it on the other side of this break. Hey, all, Scott here. The thing is, I need you guys to help me to get these download numbers up. So do me a favor and sign up for the podcast feeds of this show. You can choose the whole show or just the interviews at iTunes and Stitcher. All the buttons you need are at the top of the right margin at scotthorton.org. The more subscribers I have, the more iTunes and Stitcher will help promote the show to new listeners. If you're a hardcore fan, brand new or from way back, please leave them customer ratings and reviews, too. I'm trying to get these wars ended. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Like usual, I'm talking with the great Gareth Porter. The article is at truthdig.com. Why the U.S. owns the rise of Islamic State and the Syria disaster. And, you know, I was interviewed for half an hour on this station in Fargo, North Dakota this morning. And I explained as best I could. And the guy said, whoa, dude, I don't know. You lost me. So I don't know, Garrett. You get back to telling them what you think they need to know, how you can make them understand what's important about what America's doing in Syria here.
What I was about to say before the break is not part of the story of the article that I did, we're talking about, but it is one of the implications of this story, I think, is that it's clear that the whole notion that counterterrorism is the thrust, the reason, the rationale for U.S. policy in the Middle East is simply, no longer true. I mean, it's obviously not the case that counterterrorism is what is driving U.S. policy at all. And I'm sure you've seen the same evidence that I've seen, that there is a subtle, unannounced, unofficial trend in U.S. policy to at least cooperate with U.S. Middle Eastern allies in having al-Nusra emerge as the main way of trying to block ISIS. In other words, Al-Qaeda has become a de facto quasi-ally of the United States in Syria as a way of trying to defeat or at least to prevent the victory of ISIS.
No, first, in order to defeat Assad or at least bleed Assad's army, and then now their secondary excuse is to hem in the Islamic State.
Well, I'm not so sure that the purpose of the Obama administration is to primarily defeat the Assad regime. I don't think that's the case. I'm not convinced.
Well, I lean toward the latter explanation there. Just bleed them. I mean, that was what the Israelis said in the New York Times. We just want to keep both sides hemorrhaging permanently, but not really see one side defeat the other.
Well, all we have to do is nothing in order for that to happen. That's for sure. The hemorrhaging is going to continue. But I think, you know, all I'm saying is that the effective U.S. Policy in the Middle East now is to cooperate in an effort to make Al-Qaeda in Syria into the chosen mechanism for blocking ISIS to, you know, the ability of ISIS to take power in Syria. And so that, to my way of thinking at least, means the end of counterterrorism as the basic thrust of U.S. policy. And I'm not saying that it was ever, you know, sincerely the reason why the United States ever did anything. As you know very well, my own view is different from that. I think it's always the rationale for doing things is different from the actual motivation of the national security state. But that's a separate question.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the way one could put it, like me, over and over again, would be what George Bush did for Al-Qaeda was just unbelievably great. The best thing he could have ever done, giving them all of Western Iraq and Northwestern Iraq to be their training ground for all those years and radicalize all those people to their cause and that kind of thing. But that was because he was a stupid idiot. And that was not how it was supposed to happen. It was supposed to be easy and et cetera, et cetera. But what, you know, if there's a real end to counterterrorism, it's when they killed bin Laden and then turned right around and started back in Al-Qaeda in Libya. And then, as you say, the red line and the rat line by Hirsch, as he shows and the DIA reports confirm, started funneling those Mujahideen fighters off to go to war in Syria in 2011. I mean, at that point, Belhaj and Hasidi and others of these Libyan Islamic Fighting Group guys said, yeah, we fought with Zarqawi against the Americans in Iraq. What of it? Thanks for the help, John McCain and Barack Obama.
And let's not forget, as I point out in my article, that the whole notion, the details of how the Islamic State would unfold, the strategy, was cooked up by the future leaders when they were in Al-Buqa, U.S. military prison in Iraq. I mean, it was right there under the noses of the U.S. Prison guards that the leaders got together and were able to basically make the plans that they carried out beginning in 2011, 2012.
Yeah.
So again, you know, one of the points that I make in my piece is that the United States has had an impact on the rise of the Islamic State through not just a single intervention, but a whole series of interventions that powerfully, directly or indirectly, gave Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and then Islamic State, the opportunity to flourish and to become what they are today.
Right. Some of it deliberate, some of it just blowback. Whether we're fighting them or fighting for them, we're making them a bigger and bigger problem all the time, either way. Now, so let me ask you this. I don't have time to play the Biden clip or the Michael Flynn clip here, but are you familiar with, obviously, you must be familiar with the DIA report. I think you must link to it in here.
Yes.
The 2012 one from August 2012 here. But then there's also the interview with Michael Flynn by Al Jazeera, where he very much confirms that this was an important piece of paper. It wasn't just another snowflake floating around the Pentagon or something. It was on his desk. He said he took it with him to the White House to make the case to the president and the rest of them that, just so you know here, these guys want to create an Islamic State. And he didn't say the Islamic State and Baghdadi works for the CIA or anything like that, but he said this is the very likely, very dangerous result of our policy in Syria, is a new Islamic State that will include Western Iraq too. And he said that they heard him loud and clear and they went ahead and did it anyway, quite deliberately.
Well, of course, what he didn't say is that his pal Petraeus was the primary person who was pushing for that policy. So, I mean,
right.
You know, he's I'm sorry to say, or not sorry to say, but I think it has to be said that Flynn is somebody whose judgment is inherently questionable, flawed, because of his close association with Petraeus and the fact that he has his own personal and institutional interests to defend. Mm. I mean, that's not to say that everything he says is wrong. I obviously would not want to dismiss everything he says, but we have to be very cautious with everything that Flynn says as well.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting that, I guess, the DIA, I mean, whoever wrote up that report, they weren't feeling that much pressure from Petraeus since he was over at CIA. They went ahead and wrote it up.
The report itself, it was perfectly accurate. It was right on the money. And there's no doubt in my mind that it was, you know, taken seriously throughout the administration. And in fact, in 2012, as I say, I mean, the White House was rejecting the Petraeus proposal to pour more money and to try to pick winners, or not winners, but to pick our favorites among the rebel groups and to make them, try to make them our guys in the Syrian war.
Not that they called off the program. You're just saying that he rejected Petraeus' proposal to escalate the program.
Again, it's a multi-level reality here. On one hand, you know, Petraeus was in mid 2012 proposing, you know, a comprehensive policy of training, vetting, and arming the, you know, our opposition forces. That was new. What had already been going on, again, secretly through a CIA extremely covert operation, was that arms had been moving, you know, from Libya to Syria since late 2011, since October 2011. So, you know, that was going on. And again, we don't know exactly who the intended recipients were and exactly who was handing them over, to Syrian rebels. But, it was an extremely complicated situation at that point, is all I'm saying.
Right. I got you. Well, there's a funny, ABC News story from last week. The State Department is really interested in figuring out how ISIS got all those Toyotas. They got them from the State Department. The State Department themselves put it in Public Radio International, which is just American government international propaganda radio. It's their own report. It says, yeah, we're doing a great job funneling Toyotas to the Islamists in Syria now. And in fact, it was even a news story that this plumber in Corpus Christi, Texas, who had sold an old Ford F-250 or something like that, had his truck was seen on TV and on YouTube full of jihadists fighting with his phone number and the name of his company still on the side of his truck. And so he was getting prank calls and threats and all these things. And it's obviously it's because the State Department bought the truck and gave it to him. Where the hell else would they have gotten it from?
State Department didn't give it directly to ISIS. They gave it to one of...
Well, the FSA who gave it to ISIS is the point.
He turned it over to ISIS, yeah.
Or al-Nusra, whichever at that point. But
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing. Is there, oh, we got to solve this mystery. Oh yeah, it's such a mystery where thousands of Toyota trucks came from. I wonder, you know, like they couldn't just, in their little system type in, you know, Saudi, Japan exchanges in their little computer system and find out every little one of these, arrangements, you know?
Well, the real person who should be feeling the heat at this moment, in my view, is David Petraeus. I mean, the role that he's played in this, is so, extremely irresponsible. It raises fundamental questions about, you know, his intentions, about what he thinks he's up to, and what he has actually done. And the fact that this has not been covered by the, big media in the United States, in my view, is one of its many sins of omission that are extremely serious.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I guess it is when he's in the Daily Beast saying, you know, hey, yeah, we really ought to be supporting Al-Qaeda right now, everybody. That kind of reminds me of Dick Cheney going on TV and going, yeah, you're damn right, I'm a torturer, and I'm proud of it. Because at that point, it's like a limited hangout kind of a thing. It's a get out ahead of the story in a way and say, you know, so that, you know, like that that Harrison Ford movie where the president's friend is a drug dealer and gets busted. And he says, go ahead and say that he's your best friend in the whole world. That way they have nowhere to go with it. You know?
Yeah. So the other thing about, this mess that we're talking about at the moment is that former, Supreme Commander of NATO, Admiral Stavridis, I believe I'm pronouncing it correctly, has also come out not just talking like Petraeus has about, well, you know, we should try to win over some of the people who are supporting al-Nusra in Syria, but saying, yeah, we ought to be supporting al-Nusra and al-Qaeda in Syria. You know, they are our allies, de facto allies.
Yeah.
So that's how far things have gone from any profession of real counterterrorism as a policy in the Middle East.
Yeah, they even did a big front page cover story on Foreign Affairs in Foreign Affairs Journal in March saying, yeah. I forget the title of it now, but oh, it's accepting Al-Qaeda. And they actually, you know, they don't show Golani or some Syrian jihadist. The picture on the cover story, the picture is Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri.
Yeah,
you know, remember your old Goldstein hate figures, you know, the guilty party. And they're not even really trying to whitewash it. They're just saying, here, swallow this.
Yeah. To me, this is Exhibit A in the case for the United States getting out of the Middle East lock, stock, and barrel.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'll leave it at that.
I'll let you go with that one. Thank you so much, Gareth, as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
That's the great Gareth Porter, everybody. This time, he's at Truth Dig. And here it is. Why the U.S. owns the rise of Islamic State and the Syria disaster. He's got all your links and all your context. And in fact, now that we're over time and I'm still going anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play a couple more sound bites so that you'll have them attached to the end of this interview. Here's, first of all, Obama's answer to Benjamin Swan, or Ben Swan, he goes by.
I share that concern. And so what we've done is to say we will provide non-lethal assistance to Syrian opposition leadership that are committed to a political transition, committed to an observance of human rights. We're not going to just dive in and get involved with a civil war that, in fact, involves some elements of people who are genuinely trying to get a better life, but also involve some folks who would, over the long term, do the United States harm.
And here's Michael Oren, Benjamin Netanyahu's former ambassador to the United States, explaining why, from Israel's point of view, they prefer Al-Qaeda and explicitly including the Islamic State to Hezbollah and Syria.
If we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail.
So, again, an explicit reference to ISIS massacring Iraqi soldiers in the field there, not just some Sunni Islamists, the mythical moderates. He's directly referring to the Islamic State. And why? Because Assad is responsible for everyone who's died on all sides of the civil war, even though 100,000 of those casualties are Syrian army casualties. But never mind that. And then his other reason, because Iran has nuclear weapons and is going to give them to Assad and Hezbollah. What a pile of crap, but hey, good enough for American policy to take the side of Al-Qaeda. And here's one more from Joe Biden on America and our allies' role.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, the Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. They were so determined to take down Assad, they poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad, except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, y'all, Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhortonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottWhortonShow. And thanks, y'all. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Here it is. Sorry you weren't supposed to be able to hear me cursing under my breath there. I was trying to find the article I'm looking for. We are the masters, says Israeli mayor, as three more Palestinians are killed. This report from yesterday by Charlotte Silver, an independent journalist in San Francisco, formerly based in the West Bank and writing for Electronic Intifada. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Charlotte?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Very happy to have you here. Appreciate it. Very important work that you're doing here. I'm sorry, you're reporting from there or from here at this point?
I'm in Oakland, California right now, okay, not in Palestine.
All right. I just like to imagine where in the world the person I'm talking to is. That's
right.
All. And anyway, you tell a lot of very important stories in this one here, and I'm sorry, there may be a new one since then, since the We Are the Masters. But can we start with that? The Israeli mayor of what said, we are the masters in of who and in what context?
Sure. Well, I would just like to add that 4 more Palestinians have been killed since I wrote published that piece on Monday, one of whom was shot at a protest in a refugee camp in Bethlehem. So, you know, it's every day that more violence, more deaths are mounting. And the majority of the deaths and injured are Palestinians, and particularly Palestinian youth. Young people as young as 13 years old are being shot at protests. But the context of that quote by a mayor of a town, in the north near Haifa in the north of Israel, was said in response to, the residents of the town sort of, pressuring him to crack down, in their village. Not that the village had experienced any violence, but it was sort of a call to criminalize Palestinians there. And so he was specifically ordering his police to start monitoring construction sites, asking construction workers to show their national IDs, show their permits, etc., in this town, sort of a way of harassing Palestinians inside the state of Israel.
Mm-hmm. Just basically as a show of force.
Right. I think so.
We are the masters. All right. Now, you know, I'm sorry, because you're right to start off with the killings and the death, and obviously that's what's important. But, you know, the terminology so often just gives people away and really goes, I think, to explain the context in ways that, you know, just who shot who sometimes. You know, if we watch CNN, you'd think that Palestine is the country next door that never stops trying to invade Israel and steal it. So,
right. And I think that that's a really good point, that this is a lot of what the responses Israel's had to, you know, the rash of attempted stabbing attacks that have occurred, and also just protests. Remember, 17 of the 31 Palestinians that have been killed have been Palestinians at protests. But the majority of the response the Israeli government has had is essentially to show, their might, a show of force, a show of who is in control. And this is from the very beginning, of the month, when this latest surge in violence began. Israel started implementing new measures, harsher measures of penalties and other types of a show of force, like increased of home demolitions, a form of collective punishment in which suspects of attacks are the homes of suspects of attacks are destroyed, supposedly as a deterrent measure. The Israeli police force, civilian police force in Jerusalem and the rest of Israel, have been given permission to use live ammunition on protesters. And we're seeing reservists of border police flooding the streets of Jerusalem now. And now, as this morning, the morning of Wednesday, are starting to enforce closures on Palestinian areas of East Jerusalem.
All right. And so that's kind of what I'm getting at, too, with the context. There was an article at Mondo Weiss about an NPR news report where they just don't mention the occupation at all. And, you know, I got to say, I think it's important. I don't know. I'm not just talking about myself, but I'm saying, in my experience as growing up in a kid in Texas, I never had much Zionist propaganda, pro-Zionist propaganda around me at all. But I never had someone explain that when they say the West Bank and Gaza, these are lands that were conquered way back in the 1960s. And the people there are, they're still Palestinians that live there, but they're under the rule of the Israelis. They just never explain that. They never put the map in the little square above the newscaster's shoulder and give you the 101 at all. If you have read about the occupation, well, then lucky you. But if you're just a regular American, as far as you know, the Palestinians already have a state, and why won't they ever stop attacking the poor Israelis? Because it just, that's what they're left to conclude, basically, because of the lie by omission. And so when you have a bunch of people going around saying, we are the masters, we control this checkpoint, we control, we are going to demolish your house, we're going to do this, that, and the other thing, that sure doesn't sound like the Palestinians invading and occupying the Israelis to me.
Right. And, you know, remember this, it's also Jerusalem that's occupied, and this, and it's Jerusalem where the majority of Palestinian, where it's sort of the heat is strongest. This is where you're seeing Palestinians attempting to attack Israeli policemen and others, and Israel is cracking down with the largest amount of force. And Jerusalem is supposed to, you know, Israel doesn't even pretend that East Jerusalem is under consideration to be given back to Palestinians. It was annexed immediately after it was occupied, and it treats it like its own, it's part of its own sovereign territory.
All right, now let's see. I guess we only have a couple of minutes left before this break, but if maybe you just want to pick any one of these stories of the recent innocent Palestinians gunned down, killed, that is, by the IDF or by settlers, that you'd like to bring to people's attention?
Well, there are a number of teenagers who have been shot at protests, shot with lethal force, you know, in the neck, in the chest. This is a shoot to kill policy, and some of them have been protesting, some of them have not. There was the case of a 13-year-old in Ida refugee camp near Bethlehem, who was standing many meters away from the protest and on a stoop, and he was shot dead. But the shoot to kill policy that's being inflicted on Palestinians at protests is also being inflicted on Palestinians who are alleged to have attempted stabbing. And, you know, I think that we need to look at these reports of attempted stabbings very critically. Many of them are not ending in any kind of injury, and yet Israel is enforcing a shoot to kill policy, which is not necessarily proportionate to the risk they pose. And just recently, almost all the human rights organizations in Israel, B'Tselem, Yesh Adin, Association for Civil Rights in Israel, Amnesty International in Israel, have condemned this policy that's been promulgated by ministers of the Knesset, heads of Jerusalem police force, and they've condemned this policy as disproportionate. You know, even in the case of a Palestinian taking out a knife, shoot to kill policy is disproportionate. So I think that the deaths that we're seeing are not necessary, and we have to look critically at all of them. Mm.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. And you know, especially when you consider that just because the IDF said he had a knife or the police say he had a knife doesn't mean he really had a knife. That just means that that's a thing that a cop said. In fact, that would be an indication that it's not true. And if we were talking about Americans here, they would be presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's my same standard for, you know, well-armed soldiers and police shooting guys, and then all they have is a dropped knife because no one would believe them if they had a dropped gun. But anyway, hold it right there, Charlotte. We'll be right back, everybody, with Charlotte Silver from the Electronic Intifada. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back. That's funny. Check your head. It's oldies but goodies now, huh? I guess so. Yeah, I'm old. All right, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Charlotte Silver from electronicintifada.net. Electronicintifada.net. We are the masters, says Israeli mayor, as three more Palestinians are killed. And as she elaborated, there have been, I think she said four more since then. And we were talking about the knives. And that brought up to me this story, and I don't want to talk about it again, but I want to make sure that people who hear just the interviews get a chance to hear about this story. Could you please tell them about Ahmed Manasra, the 14-year-old boy?
Yeah, so Ahmed Manasra and his cousin, Hassan, are alleged to have attacked a few Israelis in the large Israeli settlement block near Jerusalem, Pisgat Ze'ev. And his cousin Hassan, who was, I believe, 16 years old, was shot on the spot. And Ahmed was, I believe, rammed with a car. And there's a very haunting video of him lying on the ground, bleeding, his body is contorted, his legs are obviously broken or severely injured. They're in positions that no body would naturally make. And he's gasping for breath, and surrounding him are presumably residents of the settlement, Jewish Israelis shouting at him, die, and then calling him various terms, and some ordering the policeman to finish him off, to put a bullet in him, to kill him. This video is emblematic of an attitude in, not just in settlements in Jerusalem, in the rest of Israel, of, and like we were saying, the residents in the town in the north, calling on their mayor to crack down on Palestinians. This is an attitude that's been sort of bred in Israeli society by portraying all Palestinians as terrorists, and like you said, not putting any of their actions into a political context, their violence is always sort of pathologized or treated as senseless. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal that swipes away any possibility that there's a political context for Palestinian violence right now, and just describes it simply as bloodlust or a blood fetish. And these are claims that are purely racist. There's a sort of casting of Palestinian violence as a part of their ethnicity, as opposed to a part of a political context.
Yeah, well, and then the next excuse will be Islamic extremism or whatever it is. Always an excuse. But here's the thing about this: you watch this video, and it's just absolutely repulsive. You mentioned the people being shot and slaughtered at the protests. There's video of that too. It's just horrible. But this picture, you think how horrible it is, but all you have to do is just stop for 1 second and say, what if the shoe was on the other foot? What if the caption here was a bunch of Palestinian Arab Muslims chanting die and the rest of these horrible things that they say to a 14-year-old young Jewish boy laying shot, bleeding on the ground? Holy crap. America would probably invade and finish the Nakba, drive them all into the Jordan River or into Egypt.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's important to point out that it's not just Israeli security forces like the army and the police who are killing Palestinians. It's also Israeli citizens. Settlers are, there's lots of video footage of settlers throwing stones, setting fields on fire with the protection of the Israeli army. And also the mayor of Jerusalem is encouraging all residents to procure arms and to use their arms, carry their guns around and use them if they feel like an attack is coming on. And so there's the opposite. There's the sort of a sort of encouragement of violence against Palestinians by Jews right now.
Yeah, it's really something else to see. I really wish people would watch this footage. It seems like, you know, Mike Brown was such a change. Black people getting shot in the street by cops on a daily basis. White people, too, on a regular basis. But it took this humiliation of Mike Brown's corpse, basically, mm-hmm. to finally, and then the insane overreaction of the police that night to the protests that came out over it to finally kind of tip the scale to make police brutality in this country finally an issue. And it seems mm-hmm. like, man, if the American people could ever be shocked into understanding that Palestinians are human and what's happening to them is not fair and it's on our dime, it might could be this very one. This video of this young boy laying there. And I guess you report here he's still alive in critical condition. Thank goodness. His cousin was killed. But, you know, even the meanest little 13-year-old gets away with stabbing a bunch of people and then is shot in, and assuming the truth of this story, I'm saying, and this happened in America, and then he's laying there on the ground shot. Now it's the duty of every adult nearby to try to stop the bleeding and save his life and protect him until the EMS gets there and let him go to juvie or whatever mm-hmm. thing, but sit there and mock him and laugh at him and wish him dead and hope that he bleeds out, dying, a 14-year-old boy who looks younger than that to me. I mean, man, mm-hmm. this is just so out of control. And it's, you know, as you say, it's the settlers and the cops too. And I mean, the message there is loud and clear, if you ask me. I wish that's the one that would finally go viral here. Breakthrough.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, I think that Americans and probably the rest of the world are very inculcated in sort of vilifying violence that's perpetrated by someone who's not in a uniform. There's something about when someone in a uniform with a helmet on and a sniper gun shoots someone at a protest, there's something very impersonal about it, and it's kind of this cold violence. Whereas violence perpetrated by someone, you know, a 13-year-old or a 20-year-old or whatever it is, taking a gun and stabbing someone, that's the only kind of violence we really know how to condemn or be horrified by. And so I think that, you know, I think that a lot of Israeli violence gets a pass because it is, the majority of it is perpetrated by men in uniforms.
Yep. All right. Well, with that, I will let you go. And thank you so much for your time, for your great journalism and your time again on the show, Charlotte.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
All right, y'all. That is Charlotte Silver. She is at electronicintifada.net. This one is called "We Are the Masters," says Israeli mayor. We'll be right back. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment. MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Latest by Ray McGovern is at antiwar.com. How CNN shapes political debate. Very interesting. He also writes at consortiumnews.com. He's got his own site, raymcgovern.com. Did I mention he formerly was a CIA analyst for 27 years, and now he's a peacenik, co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and goes around giving speeches about why people should be anti-war and great stuff like that. VIPS, they write memos to the president about why he ought to stop doing all the horrible things that he does. Welcome back to the show. Ray, how are you doing?
Thanks, Scott. Doing well.
Good. Very happy to have you on the show. So, we got to talk about the plane that was shot down over Ukraine, and the new report that's come out all about it. I don't guess, maybe you've had a chance to write something, but I don't think it's been published yet about this.
Well, you can check my raymcgovern.com website. The stuff is up there. They're mostly interviews.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so I look forward to a long, in-depth piece for Consortium News or something like that. But so I got dibs on you first anyway. MH17 is the name of the plane. The point is that it's the Dutch have finished their investigation of what happened to the plane. Now, they don't, I don't believe, come out officially blaming anyone, but they do say that the plane was downed by a Buk missile launcher. That doesn't necessarily help all that much because the Ukrainians and the Russians both have them. But there are many discrepancies, and they're already being fought about. I know you've read the report, so go ahead and let us have it.
Well, one of the things people should know, Scott, about the report is that a full participant was a country called Ukraine. It's really quite bizarre to have one of the prime suspects participating fully in the investigation. Why are the Belgians involved? Why were the black boxes given to the UK? I mean, there's so many anomalies here that the notion that a transparent investigation has taken place, well, you know, if you believe that, I can sell you a Brooklyn Bridge. The Dutch have been under our, well, I call them a vassal state of the United States, no different from many other European countries. They haven't differed with U.S. policy on anything in 3-4 decades, okay? So when the Dutch Safety Board was given the task of looking into that, you could pretty much predict that if they had evidence blaming the Russians, they would certainly include that. If they had no evidence, including the Russians, or blaming the Russians, they would be what they are right now, wishy-washy. They think it was a Buk missile. The Ukrainians have Buk missiles. So the Russians have lots of people that have Buk missiles. But the point is, and what I have tried to drive home and the people I've talked to, is this. The notion that we have to rely on social media, as John Kerry said 3 days after the shootdown, he described social media as an extremely important tool. Now, the tool for what? Tool for truth or tool for misinformation? Well, he came on all of the Sunday talk shows and blame the Russian, the pro-Russian, the Russian, the Russian missile, Russian, you know, it was Putin. And the evidence he had used was social media, you know, video and stuff like that, except for one thing. And most people have missed this, Scott. I'm going to read because I don't want to misquote him. He was on with David Gregory, as well as all the other Sunday showstoppers. And this is what he told David Gregory on July 20, so 3 days after the shootdown. Quote, "We picked up the imagery of this launch. We know the trajectory. We know where it came from. We know the timing. And it was exactly at the time that this aircraft disappeared from the radar. Period." End quote. Whoa. So, John, you You've got more than just social media, huh? Where is it? Show us the beef. Did it appear in the Dutch safety people report? No. So either John Kerry has more than social media or he doesn't. Last person I talked to said, well, wait a second, Ray. This is probably very sensitive stuff. And, you know, sources and methods probably preclude the U.S. government from sharing that. Well, not really. I referred this person to an incident back in the Reagan years, the 1980s, when we had evidence that the Libyans were responsible for killing a whole bunch of people at a Berlin disco. Okay, how do we know that? We had the intercepted message. Now, Reagan, acting on that, bombed the hell out of Gaddafi's palace, killed one of his children, and the world was, you know, kind of outraged. What evidence did you have that it was the Libyans that did that disco bombing? And Reagan came to us and he said, you know, show me that intercept. So we showed it to him. He said, well, we're going to have to release this. Said, no, you can't do that. No, you can't. You'll blow our source. It's encrypted. They'll know. He says, release it. And so the message, which pretty much said, we achieved our mission at 2:45 this morning, hurrah, hurrah, was released. Now, why do I raise that? I raise that because, yes, we blew that source, but Reagan thought it far more important to convince the world of what he considered the rectitude of his killing Gaddafi's son and just missing Gaddafi.
Look at Adlai Stevenson during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Here's the blown up U-2 photographs of the missiles going into Cuba. So Soviets, you're called out. You're lying. I mean, they can do that very same thing here. Let's see the blown up photos at the UN Security Council. That was what Colin Powell was, you know, pretending to replay with his cartoons of the mobile biological weapons labs back in 03. Look at me, I'm Adlai Stevenson, only all I have is cartoons because I'm lying.
Sure. Well, you know, the point is that this was a target of opportunity in terms of what Kerry had in mind. You know, Kerry had weathered a really tough storm. He had pretty much wanted the U.S. to attack Syria overtly, you know, with cruise missiles and so forth in August of 2013. And behind his back, the president worked out with Putin a deal where Syria surrendered all its chemical weapons for destruction. Okay. And they were destroyed on U.S. ships. Okay. Now, Kerry took a lot of hits on that from the neocons who were lusting for war on Syria. And so he had to prove his kind of neocon credentials, how anti-Russian he was. And so he saw this as a good opportunity to do that. And so he got up there and blamed the Russians and blamed it on social media, but also included this very curious thing about information about the trajectory, about imagery that we know where it came from. We know the timing. Well, Mr. Kerry, decent respect for the opinions of mankind would suggest that you really ought to make that available to us, and you could always sanitize it, or you can always, you know, I'll bet we had 100 pieces of information in that part of the world. It was laser-like focus during those days. So the fact that Kerry said these things, and we've not heard one word since about more reliable information than social media, suggests to me, and I hate to say this about a U.S. Secretary of State, but it suggests to me that he was lying.
Yeah, of course he's lying. He lies all the time. Hey, listen, it's Ray McGovern, everybody. And if you hold it right there, we're going to be right back. We're going to talk a little bit more about just what happened to this plane in the whatever you call it. I guess it's the Ukrainian Civil War at this point. Be right back in just a sec. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, now peacenik. We're talking about, well, the Secretary of State's claims about what evidence America had about what happened to MH17 shot down over Ukraine, and what evidence they're apparently willing to provide to the Dutch investigators, among other objections. But now, so let me play the devil's PR man here for a minute, Ray. At the time that it happened, it seemed like the Occam's razor explanation for what went on here was that the rebels screwed up. Oops, and shot down the wrong plane. The Ukrainian military had been bombing them from the sky. They didn't have an air force. They were getting bombed from the sky, and they were trying to shoot down whatever the Ukrainians were throwing at them, and they screwed up, and they killed a bunch of civilians, and then, of course, yeah, the Americans and the Empire, they seized on it to try to blame Russia, and now they're even saying, oh, it was had to have been Russian soldiers, not just rebels who did it, and whatever. They want to take advantage. But is that not the simplest explanation? Is it in dispute? How much is it in dispute, the territory where the missile apparently came from? How large is the territory in question where it may have came from, in your estimation? And how certain is it that this was government and or rebel-controlled territory? You mentioned the social media. Well, the open source guys claim to have pictures from all different sources that they've taken their time and painstakingly compiled that show that here's this missile launcher traveling from Russia into rebel territory and then traveling back again, short a missile. And yeah, pretty obvious what happened here and this kind of thing. And so, maybe it ain't fair, but I'll just play like I'm CNN and say that's the absolute truth and the burden is on you to come up with a better explanation than that.
Right. Okay. Well, this Bellingcat, this Higgins guy that's, I think, working for MI6 in the UK, his analysis, if that's the right word for it, has been disproven as being completely unreliable. The photos that were adduced to show this kind of thing were shown to have been taken at different times and at different places. So you can dismiss the Bellingcat or Elliot Higgins kind of information. That is a propaganda operation. Now, how about the Dutch safety report? Well, the safety board talked about the square, the area in which the missile may have been shot from. Now, I did some math. They gave it in kilometers. I got 200 miles square, 200 miles square, right on the border there with Russia. I've seen other figures, 130 or something like that, square miles. That's a lot of territory. Now, simple answer to your question is this. Yes, Scott, the simplest answer is what you described, but it has all kinds of problems attached to it. Number one, there's no proof that either the rebels, so-called, the anti-coup separatists there in the eastern Ukraine had a Vuk missile, had stolen a Vuk missile, or knew how to operate it if they had stolen or acquired it. There's absolutely no reason to believe that the Russians would have any incentive to send down one of their advisors. Oh, here's how you shoot down a passenger plane. So you're right. It could have been a terrible mistake. It could conceivably have been done by the pro-Russian rebels, but I don't think so. What we have here is an immediate rush to judgment. John Kerry saw this as a, no pun intended here, a target of opportunity, okay? What he was trying to do was rally European support for sanctions against Russia, over the Ukraine. They had been very reluctant to do that. And 2 weeks after the Russians were blamed for the shootdown, the Europeans imposed significant sanctions, sanctions that not only hurt the Russians, but hurt them. Now, when the Europeans find out that this was all a crock, as I think they will, when they find out that their economies have been damaged because they were sort of mousetrapped into doing sanctions when there was no real proof that the Russians were behind that shootdown, there's going to be a little bit of dissidence among the Europeans. Now, what I've done here is gone back to earlier experiences of this kind, and I see a direct parallel. On September 1st, 1983, the Russians shot down KAL-007, a South Korean aircraft with, I think it had 269 passengers. Okay, it was a passenger plane. It had strayed way into Soviet airspace, and the U.S. seized on that. This was Reagan. This was the evil empire. This was the arms merchants that were hell-bent on making an anti-ballistic missile system. They had to make the empire really evil. And so they said the Russians admit that they shut this down, and they did it deliberately knowing that it was a passenger aircraft. A lie. Now, how do I know that? Well, among the ways I know it is that the guy in charge of this propaganda effort in the State Department, his name is Alvin A. Snyder. And he's written a book, and the book he called Warriors of Deceit. Now, what did he say? He said, well, I had a job to do. I had to produce a video, and the perception we wanted to convey was that the Russians had cold-bloodedly carried out a barbaric act knowing that it was a civilian airliner. Now, a decade later, this guy Snyder saw the complete transcripts, not just the 7 minutes he was given. These are transcripts between pilot and command control, okay? Now, he then realized that a lot of what was in the U.S. presentation before the U.N. on this occasion was false. It was clear to Snyder that Reagan administration wanted to present these false accusations, not only to fool the U.N., but to fool the people of the United States about how bad this evil empire was. To the end, you know, to that end, smearing the Soviets, well, that justified the means of falsifying the historical record and the intelligence. Now, what was the moral that Snyder draws in his book? This is going to get you, Scott. Okay. He acknowledges his role in the deception, but he draws a sort of ironic lesson from the incident. Now, he's a very senior official in the State Department. This is what he says, quote, "The moral of the story is that all governments, including our own, lie when it suits their purposes. The key is to lie first," end quote. So whoever lies first wins. And that's exactly what John Kerry decided to do on the 20th of July, 3 days after the shootdown, on the 17th of July, 2013.
All right. Now, so then is it fair to say that you think you prefer the explanation anyway, more likely to you, something like that, that it was the government that shot down, the Ukrainian government or a faction loyal to it that shot down the plane? Well, why would they have done it?
Well, you know, you have a bunch of oligarchs there. You have a bunch of unguided missiles. And I don't really come down on one side or the other. All I think is that Kerry's case is not proven and that there are alternative explanations which are more likely. And I guess what I do, Scott, and I'm an intelligence analyst, not a journalist, okay? So give me a little leeway here. We were forced to make judgments based on very, very partial evidence. And my judgment here is that if what Kerry bragged about having, information about the imagery of the launch, the trajectory, where it came from, the timing, if he had that information, he would certainly release it. The fact that he doesn't have that information, the fact that he will not release that information, I am morally convinced that the U.S. has the information knowing exactly who did this. The fact that they don't release that information suggests strongly to me as an intelligence analyst that it does not support what Kerry got up and said 3 days after the shootdown. Mm-hmm. And so it would just be too embarrassing to release. They have the Dutch, have the Dutch by the leash, and they have the Belgians and everybody else. Ukrainians, as I pointed out before, were part of this investigation. Right. And there were reports saying that nothing could be concluded unless it was unanimous. So we remain uncertain with respect to exactly how it happened. But look, you had the sanctions imposed, right? It worked, okay? Whoever lies first wins.
There you have it. All right, everybody. That's the great Ray McGovern, former CIA intelligence officer, now Peacenik, veteran intelligence professionals for sanity. And he writes at raymcgovern.com and consortiumnews.com. Thanks again, Ray. Sure appreciate it.
Most welcome.
And everybody else, also check out this piece at Foreign Policy. Winter is coming, and so is Ukraine's far right, all about the possibility of another right-wing coup d'etat there.